The SS personnel Zimmer had sent to accompany John Rourke and Paul Rubinstein had not worn uniforms, but instead cold-weather casual clothes. The trolley was parked near what appeared to be an access into the trolley tunnel. John Rourke stripped away his protective clothing, stuffing it into the teardrop-shaped rucksack which had been on his back. The rifle would be another matter. But it wasn't an immediate problem. Beneath the protective gear, Rourke wore snow clothes over boots. Aside from the fact that he was sweating in them, they were sartorially inappropriate as well. He stripped these away. Beneath the snow gear, Rourke wore a long-sleeved black knit shirt and black slacks, bloused over combat boots. John Rourke and Paul Rubinstein had planned ahead. Paul was already stripped down to a gray long-sleeved knit shirt and black slacks. Rourke took his battered old brown leather bomber jacket from the teardrop-shaped rucksack, pulling it on over the double Alessi shoulder holster that he wore. Paul was setting his second Browning high power into a black ballistic nylon double tri-speed shoulder rig. Rourke had one of these at the retreat.
I do not like this.
Ah, don't worry. You should love these people.
Yes, but you will not, eh?
None of us will if you open your mouth with a German accent. Let us do the talking if we make it that far.
Paul pulled on a leather jacket.
Ready.
You and Spitz take care of the trolley.
This is a disgrace.
Nazi or no, Dr. Men struck me as a good soldier. I think if he were able to comment, he'd agree.
Spitz just shook his head, but started for the trolley. Rourke caught up his gear, slinging the rucksack over his left shoulder, the rifle in his right hand. He started into the access way. Fewer than 3 yards into it, he required light. From his bomber jacket, he took a mini mag light. With the little flashlight shielded by his left hand, Rourke moved cautiously along. While he investigated this little tunnel, Paul and Spitz would be completing the rigging of the trolley. Dr. Mentz's body would be left in it. The audio-animatronic motorman could be remotely disabled. Instead, Mentz's body would be lashed to the controls, his weight keeping the dead man switch, a quite literal description in this case, from activating and stopping the train. High explosives were set so that the trolley and anything near it would be all but vaporized. The charges were preset for 3 minutes. From beyond the mouth of the access way, Rourke could hear the trolley starting out. Ahead, in this barely shoulder-width tunnel, he saw nothing within the beam from his flashlight except more tunnel. He moved on, reminding himself that it had to lead somewhere. The access way indeed led out of the trolley tunnel. And as he had suspected, the trolley tunnel, after they had covered the distance between the hidden entryway and the mountain itself, had been leading them not in a straight line, but progressively downward. The trolley system, it appeared, went from ground level to some point far below, too far for Rourke to clearly discern as he looked over the edge into the man-made abyss. And perhaps he was better off not knowing at the moment. Above, however, the central core, it was buttressed expertly at every level, seemed to narrow. It was more than an optical illusion. Perhaps it narrowed to a tunnel leading upward. But to what? What John Rourke supposed was a death chamber, from which the lethal hallucinogenic gas was expunged into the atmosphere. There was a chasm to cross, only 18 or 20 feet wide here, but wide enough that it could not be jumped by anyone but an Olympian with a good deal of luck. On the opposite side was a metal-runged ladder leading upward and downward, periodically terminating when it reached one of the core levels. And some 50 or so feet above, and a nearly equal distance below, there was a covered synth-concrete-looking span, perhaps a pedestrian walkway from one of the trolley stations. But the nearest of these walkways was at least 100 yards away, laterally. How was this tunnel, at the mouth of which he crouched, accessed? Two things happened simultaneously, and John Rourke did a third. He heard Paul and Spitz coming up behind him. He saw a man armed with some sort of submachine gun-sized weapon flying toward him, harnessed within some sort of personal minicopter. John Rourke dove back into the tunnel.
Quiet. Stay down.
This was how the access ways to the trolley system were reached, by these personal helicopter devices. As Rourke crouched beside his suddenly silenced companions, and the armed man in the flying rig hovered over the just-extended platform, Rourke glanced at the Rolex on his left wrist. 3 minutes would just about be up. The enemy soldier, or whatever he was, wheeled toward them with his weapon. John Rourke drew the A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome and dove toward the man. Rourke pushed himself away from the body. It lay half-extended over the platform, the rotor blades from the bizarre personal flying rig clear of any contact with the platform, the rig apparently wholly undamaged.
What have we gotten ourselves into?
Both Rourke and Spitz found themselves insisting on using the flying rig. Rourke realized the sound of reason when he heard it and let Paul have his way. Paul was harnessed into the flying rig, standing halfway out along the length of the platform. Around his waist was the climbing rope which had been lashed to Rourke's rucksack. Should the flying rig prove inoperable to someone not trained on it, Paul would cut the power and ball himself inward in order to avoid the blades. The rope, unless he fell so rapidly that the rotor blades would still be moving with sufficient force to sever it, would save him from a fall to his death.
You sure you want to do this?
No. I'm sure I don't want to do it, but I'm closest to Bill than the guy we took this off, so it seems logical.
Rourke ducked below the rotor blades and clasped his friend's right hand in both of his.
Well, good luck.
I'll try to make it to the lower crossover if something goes wrong. Otherwise,
get across to the other side and tie off the rope.
Above them, by about 20 feet, and on the other side of the chasm, formed between the central structure and the outer shell where they stood now, was what appeared to be an opening into one of the levels of the central core.
Good luck, June.
Right.
Paul half-stepped, half-lifted off the platform, and there was a sickening feeling in the pit of John Rourke's stomach when, for an instant, his friend nearly vanished from sight. But then Paul, jerkily, not smoothly, like the dead man from whose body the flying rig was taken, rose and started across the chasm. Emma Shaw awoke, feeling a human hand over her mouth. Her pistol was in her right hand.
Keep still. I have to silence my mount. We have company up above. Don't move.
The pressure over her mouth eased. She rolled onto her abdomen, smelling smoke. What had remained of the campfire was evidently just struck. Snow that was still not fully melted to water heaped over it, and above her she heard sounds too now. Machine sounds. She wriggled out of her sleeping bag. Perhaps her senses cleared a bit, because another question reared its very ugly head. Had whoever it was up there seen them? Emma Shaw shivered, lying to herself that it was just the sudden exposure to the night air making her so cold. Gloved hand over hand, John Thomas Rourke worked his way upward along the tied-off rope. Beneath him, if he slipped, he calculated there was at least 1,000 feet before his anticipated trajectory would bring him in contact with one of the crossovers and kill him. Rourke kept moving. Paul, the submachine gun in a ready position, but his eyes on the rope, crouched on a narrow ledge beside a low, camel-colored synth concrete wall. Rourke looked below and behind him, Gunther Spitz waiting to cross after him, guarding their backs. For the moment, it was in Spitz's best interest to cooperate, be a loyal, however ephemeral, ally. The moment would come when Spitz could not be counted on, and Rourke counted on that. Paul reached out toward Rourke now, and Rourke clambered toward his friend's hand, grasping it at last, fingers barely touching, then hands locking over wrists. In the next instant, John Rourke was crouched beside him.
A lesser man would say he's getting too old for this shit.
Yeah, or possibly just a brighter man.
As Rourke signaled toward the access way, Gunther Spitz swung onto the rope. Rourke loosened the sling on his HK, bringing the rifle to a close crossbody hold. Rourke's thumb poised beside the selector, ready to move it from safe to fire. Spitz seemed admirably fit, moving quickly, agilely.
I'll give him that. He's in good shape.
And not to mention in his mid-20s.
Ah, excuses. My mother used to say that excuses weren't worth the powder to blow them up.
Everybody's mother used to say that.
Did your mother make chicken soup with little matzo balls?
The soup, yeah, but you got me on the matzo balls.
Spitz was at the midpoint over the chasm now. Paul was watching him, so Rourke slowly, cautiously peered over the low wall. As he had approached, the angle had been wrong to see anything. Now, however, he had a reasonably unobstructed view. The wall was some 4 feet high. There was a sidewalk, wide enough to be a driveway, just beyond it. It bordered the wall, and on the far side, a park. The park was green, inviting, tree-dotted. There was a bench, a drinking fountain. Beyond the park lay another sidewalk, this one of more conventional width, and beyond that lay a street. On the street moved horse-drawn wagons and carriages. Some pedestrian traffic crossed from one side of the street to the other. Rourke followed with his eyes. On the far side of the street began a system of streets, it seemed, extending, it appeared, inward toward the hub. Lining the street directly opposite John Rourke's position was a woman's clothing shop. On one side of it, another store bearing a sign.
Mountain Market.
To Rourke's right of the market lay an animal hospital. Beside that was what appeared to be a public library. Beside the library was a stairwell, treads leading up and down. There was a street sign which Rourke tried to make out without pulling his binoculars. At last, he thought he had it.
Sector A, level 5.
His eyes drifted back toward the window of the women's apparel store. He'd never been much of an observer of women's fashion, but the clothing he was able to see seemed somehow reminiscent of the sort of thing the Beaver's mother or Donna Reed would have worn. Dresses with what seemed to be buttons down the front to the waist and full skirts which looked packed with petticoats beneath. And the mannequins all wore little hats.
Take a look.
But Paul was busy helping Gunther Spitz off the rope. Attached to Spitz's belt was a second cord. It was knotted across the chasm to the tail of the hitch they had used for tying off the rope on which they crossed. Rourke took this cord and gave it a brisk, sharp tug. The knot, just as Rourke had hoped, pulled free and the rope started to the wall. Paul and Spitz caught at it, pulling it up from the near end as quickly as they could.
And now?
I think we'll go visit Middle America.
Considering the hour, it seemed not at all remarkable that the stores were closed and there were few people on the street. If the people of this mountain community kept to any sort of truly circadian rhythm, it was 3 or 4 in the morning here. And as they left the park, the matter of time was resolved. A clock in the window of the veterinarian's read a little past 2:50.
I do not like leaving our weapons behind.
Yeah, I'm not partial to the idea either, but we'd attract instant attention if we didn't.
There were no women in evidence on the street and only a few men, these in working men's clothes, waist-length jackets and slacks, some few of the men even carrying lunch pails. Some of the men were bareheaded, some others wearing fedora-style hats or caps. In the few carriages that had passed along the street, while Rourke, Rubenstein, and Spitz had hidden their weapons in a dense row of hedges, Rourke had seen the occasional well-dressed man type, dark suit and hat, but that was it. The wagons mainly seemed to be carrying sacks or crates of produce, perhaps en route to stocking a market. Every face was white. Rourke had anticipated that. They stopped in front of the women's apparel store. Indeed, the fashions worn by the mannequins and visible through the windows in the shop within confirmed Rourke's earlier observation.
I wonder if David and Ricky's mom shopped here.
Possibly.
What is this?
This is indicative, perhaps, of a society which sees itself returning to traditional values. And again, it may be nothing more than the vagaries of fashion. Let's check that mailbox at the corner and see what's down the block.
A man wearing gray work pants and a windbreaker looked at them oddly, but nodded a greeting. Rourke nodded back. He stopped at the mailbox. It was painted green, as mailboxes had been when he was a boy. On it was stenciled United States Mail, and beneath that was a white card with pickup hours printed on it. Rourke looked down the street to his right. More stores, and beyond that, houses.
This reminds me of Albuquerque, just after the night of the war.
In more ways than one.
The street was well lit, but by streetlights and shop windows alone. Was there some sort of artificial daylight during daytime hours? As they passed a bookstore, Rourke spotted 3 uniformed men on bicycles coming their way, but down the center of the street.
Cops, get into the doorway.
Rourke, with Rubenstein and Spitz flanking him, moved quickly into the doorway of the bookstore. Rourke's right hand was under his bomber jacket, to one of the 2 scoremasters he carried in his waistband. With the exception of the Model 629, the Crane LS-10 knife, and the HK-91 rifle, John Rourke had all of his weapons. The policemen pedaled by without even looking their way, either otherwise engrossed or grossly inefficient. Paul started away, but John Rourke pulled him back.
Look in the window.
There were a variety of novels, some of them appearing to be romances, some mysteries, all by unrecognizable authors. But there was also a collection of nonfiction. One of these books was the annotated Mein Kampf, complete with a new introduction by United States Senator Charles Breen. The dust jacket featured a quote.
Those truly interested in Hitler, the man, as well as the brilliant philosopher and charismatic leader. This is the best yet.
These are my people!
If you feel like getting killed, you go right ahead and run after those policemen. I have a feeling you might not be any more welcome than we would. Heil Hitler and goose-stepping notwithstanding. And for God's sakes, don't tell me that all Nazis are brothers. That would be absurd even coming from you, Gunther.
Rourke started back onto the sidewalk, and across the street in the middle of the block, he found what he'd been looking for.
Come on.
As John Rourke knotted his tie in the mirror, it was a solid blue and felt like silk, he listened to the radio.
Good morning. This is Tom Fields with the early AM news on the Big Band Easy, sounds of WRPHAM. A spokesperson for President Dalton Cole has confirmed that four of the outside saboteurs captured overnight by the defense forces are still at large in the city. Police are combing all levels and sectors, and FBI Director Harold Hayes promises, and I quote, "These killers will be found and brought to justice before they have the chance to do their dirty work," unquote. Police urge all citizens to be on the lookout for outsiders and report all suspicious persons to the proper authorities at once. Unconfirmed reports indicate that outsiders may be of mixed race and might be able to pass for white. In other news, Defense Forces spokesmen have released casualty figures for over the weekend. In a clash with Negroes and Jews attempting to mount an attack force against the North Entry site, 32 Defense Forces personnel were killed. Tempering that sad news is the fact that more than 200 of the Negroes and some 76 Jews and a dozen more males of unidentifiable race were killed when the attack was repelled.
What does he mean, this fellow? What Negroes and Jews?
I think I may have finally added up some things which on the surface seemed rather confusing. The sum, unfortunately, is rather unpleasant.
You speak in riddles, Herr Doctor.
No, I'm not. Think. The gas we detected on the summit. For executions, it would seem. These guys have a war-footing society here, but they don't have a war. So they pretend they have a war. And even a pretend war has to have some real casualties. The good guys can't always come through unscathed. Notice that electronic shop next door? Lots of radios, record players, even some reel-to-reel tape recorders. Not a single television. Video to you, Gunther. You know why? I bet I do. You can stage still photos in a newspaper. Maybe even some newsreel footage for use in a theater. Not television coverage, or at least not so easily. So, no television, just radio.
Paul shut off the radio. Rourke took the hat which he had selected, a dark gray fedora with a broad brim and high crown, identical to the one his father had worn when Rourke was only a boy, and he placed the hat on his head, slightly cocked over his right eye.
What do you think?
Oh, that's you, John. Just like Humphrey Bogart.
Hardly. But you've already won my daughter's hand in marriage.
I see no cause for mirth from either of you. I am stranded here while my men may be enduring tortures for their fidelity to the Reich. And if you are right, Herr Doctor, then an attack is about to begin against this place.
Not much more than an initial foray to test the defenses here, I think. In any event, when we leave here, we'll find someone to volunteer the necessary information that'll enable us, hopefully, to find your personnel. Then, we get them out at least, possibly ourselves as well. What exactly did your orders say, by the way?
I was to locate two objects within the city.
And?
And I was to place the two of you under arrest. Failing that, I was to kill both of you.
And Zimmer doesn't care about his son.
I'd say Zimmer cares about his son a great deal, but not the man we have in the cryogenic sleep chamber.
John?
You didn't know about the cloning, did you, Spitz?
I do not understand either of you.
The man in the cryogenic chamber isn't Martin Zimmer.
Rourke wasn't about to divulge the fact that it was actually Michael asleep in the cryogenic chamber, left behind under guard of Natalia and Annie. But neither was it Martin Zimmer, whom John Rourke had caused to die over the volcano, half a world away in Hawaii.
He cloned his son, my son, at the same time that he cloned Wolfgang, Mon, and Sarah. No, earlier. Of course. The image of Martin and the image of me. Zimmer's joke on the world.
I fail to understand you, Herr Doctor.
He's got the original Martin, and he's got copies. Perhaps dozens of them. The basic problem with cloning a sentient being, aside from the fact that one cannot, at least in the moment I've assumed, copy the very thing which makes an individual, his mind, is the morality of it. After all, once the clone exists, he or she is a separate living being with all the inherent moral rights of a human being. He can't be used like a lab sample or a spare parts source. But to a man like Dietrich Zimmer, the morality isn't a problem. And with his undisputed mastery of advanced surgical techniques, the use of spare parts would be almost infinite.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that Dietrich Zimmer can manipulate human life to his will. What were the two targets in your order, Spitz?
The remains about which you were informed. They are here. The remains of the Führer.
That's one target. What's the other?
I do not understand why, but I was to take over a storage room which I was told would be guarded by the city's best trained troops.
No explanation as to the specific nature of the objective?
Only that if I had sufficient forces remaining which would enable me to secure one of the objectives, that was the one I must hold, lest it be destroyed.
I know why we're here. In the intelligence field, everything that's really important is on a need-to-know-only basis. And I'm sure that's the same for your people today, Gunther. Just as it was when I was part of Central Intelligence before the night of the war. You have to understand the 20th century in order to comprehend, I suppose. Science and technology never moved faster. I knew a man who was born in 1898. Now, that was well before powered flight. As a boy, he helped his father hitch horses to a wagon because it was before the automobile. He lived what would be considered a relatively brief span of years by today's standards, when practically everyone's living well past 100. But he lived to see powered flight and even fly in an airplane. He lived to see men set foot on the moon and the reusable spacecraft, all of that. Because technology never moved faster than it did in the 20th century. The body of knowledge expanded almost exponentially, not just in the United States, but in all the advanced nations of the world. And sometimes it went off at a tangent, this quest to know. Sometimes, like evolution, it went down a wrong turn, which ended up in a blind alley. Sometimes, too, it went where it shouldn't. Virtual reality. Now, you understand it was in its infancy during the 20th century, where someone could wear a clumsy helmet and a glove and perhaps stand on a treadmill and, through primitive electronics when compared to today, interact within a computer-generated environment. Now, there was a man, and I don't remember his name, but I heard about the work. It was for the Defense Department. They tried everything once, it seemed. The Navy was using psychics to assist in tracking enemy submarines, I mean, that sort of thing. This man, who worked for the Defense Department, he got the idea of recording human brain waves on a huge scale and then digitizing them. He wanted to build a computer program that would allow reading of the human mind and eventually programming the mind. Supposedly, he had the brainwave research to a point where he could translate some element patterns to test the possibility of practical application. He fed this data through a very sophisticated, for the time, very sophisticated computer array. He tried his theory on a volunteer, using the brainwave program in conjunction with virtual reality.
What happened?
Now, this was all rumor, but I found it intriguing, pursued it a bit. As best as I was ever able to ascertain, the test volunteer went insane. Sensory overload. He used a sharp piece of equipment to slash his wrist. And there was a sort of elephant's graveyard for research data and equipment. It was somewhere in the eastern United States in some bomb-proof facility. What if that was here? What if Dietrich Zimmer learned about those experiments through some reference or another? Coupling the potential of that body of research and experimentation with modern electronics and computer capabilities, and Zimmer's own work with cloning, he could create human beings almost at will.
The power of God.
In the hands of the devil.
We'll find your men, Spitz, if we can. Then find that facility. And then you'll have to decide. The research really is there. Do you want a hand in turning Earth into hell? Or will you help Paul and me to destroy it?
More personnel and equipment were arriving almost by the minute, landing at areas at the four major points of the compass. Dietrich Zimmer's plans were not on schedule. They were ahead of schedule. It would be dawn soon, and merely because it was the classic moment, his personnel were equipped with state-of-the-art night vision accessories, then the attack would begin. Everything was, at last, coming together. The conspirators within the Nazi Party would soon be eliminated. The attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii would soon be begun, and very soon, computer simulations projected a victory within 72 hours. He would possess what was the ultimate power, the power to create and manipulate life. Within his airborne command post, they were only the most trusted of his personnel. And the traitor, Graham, who had brought him the knowledge of this power's existence. Graham sat over the portside wing, staring out into the yellow-orange line along the eastern horizon. Dietrich Zimmer engaged the fellow in conversation, standing up from the couch on which he had lain to rest. He walked toward Graham.
And so, you are ready for history to unfold before your eyes?
Yes, Doctor. It will be wonderful. The destiny of the white race finally fulfilled.
Yes, indeed.
Simmer sat down on the opposite side of the table from Graham, studying the man's features. The dark eyes, the too black hair, the very pale complexion. There was a definite Slavic influence, and the name itself was from the British Isles. No racially pure fellow, this.
Coffee, Graham?
No, Doctor, thank you.
Tell me again, Graham, how your civilization came to be.
Well, like I said, Dr. Zimmer, our ancestors were white people, Christians all, and decent. We were tired of everything that was going on in America. Negroes were getting jobs and white men weren't. Jews were helping them. And women were being encouraged to be shameless sluts. It was time to do something. Folks who spoke up about what was wrong were branded. My people were being persecuted because they were God-fearing white men. We had to act or perish.
An inspiring story. That's why I never tire of it. Go on, please.
What you call the city within the mountain, we call New Jerusalem. There weren't many of us at first in New Jerusalem. When the war started between the commies and the Jew-controlled United States, well, it looked like it might be the end of white people everywhere. But some of our people had worked for the Jews in government, like secret agents, hating them all the while, but pretending to do their bidding. And they knew about New Jerusalem. It was called the Alpha Site because it was the first war retreat for the United States. Even though the war retreat was considered too vulnerable to a direct strike and was moved later, the Alpha Site was kept up in a storage facility for important government documents and things the conspirators who ran the United States government didn't want known, like the remains of Adolf Hitler being there. And our people were able to successfully infiltrate the staff that maintained Alpha Site. When it seemed that the war would be inevitable, our people took over Alpha Site. Before we had to lock down to avoid radiation, there were 179 good white Christian people inside. And we nearly died, our people. But through perseverance and the work of our scientists, we survived. There are over 30,000 of us now. But the leaders are afraid now. They made up the war, and they kill our good young men to keep making people think we can't go outside. They're afraid that we'll flourish on the face of the earth, and their power will end. It's a little clique of men, Dr. Zimmer. Some of my friends and me figured that somehow our leaders became corrupted, and that they don't really believe we'll conquer the earth. We kept hearing the rumors that there wasn't really a war, that there wasn't really an enemy. We didn't know what to think. And then one of the pilots from the scouter planes, they live in separate quarters because they might be contaminated from the outside. At least we were told that. This pilot got word out to an old friend of his. He said there weren't any Negro and Jew armies outside. And that's how our network started. With the help of some of the other pilots, we got to see some aerial photos. There were cities, that real big one you called Eden, Doctor. But New Jerusalem wasn't surrounded by enemy armies. And the glacier disappeared when you went further south. And the air was clean and fit to breathe, not poisoned. And that's when the plan was made. Five of us were supposed to go to the front. And we knew then that there wasn't a front at all, and that some of us would be taken away and executed. We knew that because we had a man who got to talk to one of the summit guards. They're the elite of the elite, like I told you, Dr. Zimmer. Turned out, though, that the summit guards don't guard anything except our own boys brought up there through some sort of elevator. Then they killed our boys. This summit guard was sick of it. So when our unit was going to move up to the front, and like I told you, nobody but the officers had a map or a compass, and units were always exfiltrated at night, the five of us in the unit figured to make a break for it and see if maybe there were other good white people like us out there.
Fortunate for you and your people that you survived.
And that you're the greatest doctor in the world, Dr. Zimmer.
When Graham was discovered wandering on the glacier, Graham's feet were frozen and gangrenous. He'd been attacked by land pirates and left for dead rather than a bullet or an energy pulse being wasted to end his life. It was the Eden Defense Forces which found him, and through a stroke of pure luck, one of Zimmer's own liaison officers working with Eden Defense Forces, Graham's feverish babbling about a hidden city to the north was overheard and reported. Zimmer personally flew to Eden, made up some story on how he could use the hapless fellow in his research, and took Graham back with him. Coincidence or synchronicity? Dietrich Zimmer's lifelong involvement with the perfection of human genetic engineering had exposed him to vague references to the brainwave research of Dr. Horace Patterson, conducted during the 20th century. Other data had convinced him of the existence of Alpha Site as the repository of various items, including the remains of Adolf Hitler, which the United States government had wished to preserve but keep secret. Logic suggested that the results of Dr. Patterson's research would be there as well. And out of the blue, along came Thaddeus Graham, a discontented private soldier with racial theories more rigid than Zimmer's own, from a society that could easily be conquered and then set to work in his own behalf because it already shared his political ideals. All that remained was to penetrate it, liberate it from its rather bizarre leadership, and absorb it, rather the way the Third Reich had absorbed Austria in 1938. He would be welcomed. He might even appoint Graham as some sort of administrator. Either that or kill him and have him posted as a martyr, whichever seemed best at the time. Dietrich Zimmer looked out the aircraft window he and Graham shared, and Zimmer squinted his eyes against the advancing sunrise. In moments, his attack on the facility at the entrance that Dr. Rourke had so kindly and stupidly found for him would begin. Alan Crockett led his horse Wilbur along the riverbed, Emma Shaw walking beside Crockett. The riverbed here at the base of the gorge was still in gray darkness, like a room in daylight with all the curtains tightly drawn and light seeping in through cracks. But above them, to the east, was nearly full daylight. They followed the sounds of the army, which had passed them in the pre-dawn hours of the morning. Above them, as she looked up, there were squadrons of high-altitude V-STOL and helicopter aircraft. There was, of course, some minuscule chance that two human beings and a horse might be detected moving thousands of feet below, but that risk had to be run. They would have been no safer, Alan Crockett had explained, had they stayed put. Emma Shaw agreed. If this were some sort of battle rather than a training exercise, and any trans-global alliance forces were committed, it might be possible to link up with them and escape this place. Maybe. Or they might be walking into something neither of them could anticipate. Each step they took brought her closer to the coastline, however. And once she was there, it would be possible in one way or another to get off the continent. That kept Emma Shaw raising one foot after the other as she picked her way along the rocks. The horse, with the funny name, of course, had to have the clearest portion of the riverbank lest it break a leg. Evidently, Crockett would feel better having to shoot her than his horse, Emma Shaw thought. John Rourke's eyes shifted from side to side as he walked down the street. Life started early here, it seemed, men dressed as factory workers gradually filling the streets. Rourke, Rubinstein, and Gunther Spitz had split up, were searching the various levels of this cylindrically shaped city within a mountain. They would rendezvous, Rourke checked his wristwatch, in another 10 minutes at the park, at the original level and sector coordinates where they had entered the city. As the early morning wore on, more persons dressed in business clothes, as Rourke himself was dressed, suit and necktie and hat, entered the streets as well. Rourke stopped in a coffee shop and had a cup, listening to the talk, glancing at the newspaper, spending some of the modest amount of money he had lifted out of the cash register at the men's store. Rourke's perusal of the newspaper proved about as interesting as reading any sort of propaganda with a dash of hometown gossip thrown in. Circulation figures for the newspaper indicated that some 12,000 copies were regularly sold. Rourke had already mentally estimated the population here to be in excess of 20,000, and the circulation figures only seemed to support that number. The coffee wasn't bad. By the time he reached the original level, and rendezvous time was near, John Rourke had discerned many bits of intelligence. He stood on the street corner, waiting for the mechanical walk sign to go on, watching the horse traffic and the bicycling policemen. They traveled in packs, and listening to the street noises. Except for the absence of internal combustion vehicles and the presence of plopping hooves, this little town, built in a spiral within the mountain, seemed very familiar to someone born in the United States in the middle of the 20th century. Except for the news stories. Those kept coming back to him. There was supposedly a bitter war raging outside the mountain. The entire economy, the entire society, was on a war footing. There were posters in shop windows urging that people buy war bonds. Race, according to the papers, was the basis for the conflict, and race seemed a constant topic of idle conversation in the streets. Not a solitary black or brown or yellow or red face was in evidence. A woman stepped up beside John Rourke at the curb. She wore a blue dress with a full skirt. The dress was made from a white polka dot fabric. A little blue hat was perched atop her head, her hair short and tightly curled. Almost involuntarily, as the light changed and she stepped off the curb, Rourke shook his head. 50s. The woman stopped for a moment in front of the window of the women's clothing store, adjusted a seam in her hose, and walked on. Rourke passed the shop, passed the Mountain Market, and stopped at the animal hospital window. It was much too early for regular office hours, of course, but there was some sign of activity within. He went past the animal hospital, his eyes on the park across the street. There was no sign of Paul or the Nazi officer Gunther Spitz. Letting Spitz go off on his own was dangerous, of course, but Rourke saw no other way in which to cover enough ground in a short period of time. The streets were filling, more horse-drawn wagons and more carriages, some apparently private, some for hire. And bicycles, not just police, but young people, the girls in bobby socks and petticoated full skirts and sweater sets, the boys in loafers, white socks, and baggy trousers, hair slicked back. A time warp. The 1950s may have been the good old days to people who had never lived them, but John Rourke remembered them, albeit with the selective perspective of childhood. Air raid drills in school, unemployment, steel strikes, two wars just over. Segregation was still in the law in many areas. Society was artificial. In that respect, the 1950s were perfectly captured here. It was time for the rendezvous in the park. The 1950s, like the 40s and 30s, had one significant advantage: men's suits. They were tailored of heavier fabric and worn looser, which made the concealment of firearms vastly easier. John Rourke wore six under his clothes, and the suit was merely taken off the rack. Rourke entered the park. No sign of Paul or Spitz yet. From fragments of casual conversation and items in the newspaper, little details one who was trained in the piecing together of information might interconnect, he was relatively certain that they would find the rest of their party, Spitz's soldiers, on Level 1, Sector A. That was above them. Level 1, Sector A was the seat of government, and most particularly where this community's self-styled FBI was housed. As he turned back toward the street, he spotted several bicycle-mounted police officers collecting near the corner, and wagons, black and enclosed, drove up. Their horses reined in quickly, men clambering out of the backs through black double doors, the men in riot gear. The staircase to the side of the library. Paul was there, starting out but then falling back. John Rourke's palms sweated. He had judged wrong. Spitz was not only more vile but more stupid than John Rourke had supposed. In the very moment when he thought the name, he looked toward the carriage which had just reined up near the curb. Sitting in it beside a chubby-looking, rather officious-seeming man, he saw Gunther Spitz. Two uniformed policemen sat opposite them, and Spitz stood up, extended his arm toward John Rourke, pointing Rourke out. John Rourke turned on his heel and ran the few steps to the hedges and threw himself up and over, rolling across the grass in his new suit. Rourke reached into the hedge, pulling against the rain poncho in which the HK-91 and the other gear was wrapped. He would need all the weapons he could muster. He had misjudged Spitz, but John Rourke had formulated a plan in case Spitz perpetrated some treachery.
If he is there, the filthy Jew cannot be far away!
The corners of John Rourke's mouth raised in an involuntary smile. He could think of no finer man on earth than Paul Rubinstein, his best friend and his daughter's husband. Quickly, as the uniformed police in full 1950s-style riot gear, helmets and clubs and revolvers and shotguns, but no visible body armor, ran in formation toward him, John Rourke checked his rifle, making certain it hadn't been spiked and left as a trap. It was as he'd left it, one of the hairs from his own head over the closed breech. Rourke slung on his musette bags, Paul's as well, the combined weight considerable with the loaded magazines and loose ammo, but he could afford to leave nothing behind. He opened the sling on the HK rifle, ran the sling through the briefcase handle, then resecured it. As the policeman started to close, Rourke rose to his full height from behind the bushes and racked a bolt on the Schmeisser. Four men went down, and the others fell back. Rourke ran, his burden slamming against him, slowing him. Ran for the low wall overlooking the chasm which surrounded the spiral of the city. Paul was firing a pistol from each hand, cutting down the riot police from behind, drawing off their fire. Rourke reached the wall and turned toward the policeman. Tear gas grenades were lobbed toward John Rourke, but there was no time to fish out the lightweight, ultra-compact protective suit or the mask from his belongings. Rourke knew what the explosions meant. Dietrich Zimmer's attack had begun. Paul Rubinstein drew back into the stairwell, bullets whining against the synth concrete surrounding him. A fresh magazine up the butt of each pistol, Paul Rubinstein stabbed the guns around the corner. It was time to withdraw. As he hit the landing, he saw a flash of blue uniform. Paul threw himself flat and rolled. He raised his pistol. As Paul pushed up to one knee, two more men charged down toward him, revolvers in hand. Paul thumbed up the safety on the pistol in his right hand and grabbed for the shotgun from the dead man nearest him. Beside the bodies of the second two riot police, Paul paused, taking their revolvers and the loose ammo from the pouches on their belts. There were no police radios. He kept going, the guns in his pockets dragging his suit coat down at the shoulders. He reached the next level. There were four police bicycles there, but no visible signs of more police. Paul started up the next flight of stairs. There were more explosions now, every few seconds. At times, the synth concrete of the city spiraled, trembling under his feet. Men and women poured from shop fronts and along the sidewalks. Now was his chance. He stepped from cover to the wall. John Rourke was into the flying harness, eyeballing the controls while he pushed his gear as clear as he could. There was a central shaft, which split into an off-angled Y shape. The frame was like a man's bicycle, the main strut rising straight toward the main rotor past maneuvering controls set up like a solid triangular-shaped handlebar. The secondary strut, to which the perch-like rest seat was attached, extended aft, the tail rotor set into its end. Riot police were closing on him now in a flying wedge. John Rourke stepped over and onto the ledge. The added weight of his burdens might be too much for the little craft. If it was, he would plummet to his death. If he stayed where he was, he would be shot to death. John Rourke jumped, both hands on the control bar. There was a sickening rush before the rotor blades fanned out, the machine evidently not designed for so abrupt a start. And no longer was he falling. But he wasn't actually flying, either, more gliding and straight toward the wall on the opposite side of the chasm. It was then that John Rourke made a decision. Testing the controls gingerly but rapidly, he started the machine upward, nearly attaining the height of the level he had just left before the wedge of riot police reached it. Rourke stabbed the Schmeisser toward them. The explosions John Rourke had heard came from above. Level 1, Sector A, had to be on ground level. As he and Paul and the others had been led to the trolley and the rest of Spitz's men had been led off in a different direction, they would have been taken straight ahead to Level 1. And that was where Zimmer's attack would originate, of course, because it was the only site for which Zimmer had coordinates. And it would be the only way out. John Rourke kept the machine climbing, at last seeing Paul's face peering out over an identical wall to that on the level he had just left. But this was the ground level, and black smoke billowed out over the wall. Concrete dust fell everywhere in the chasm surrounding the spiral city now, and large pieces from the ceiling above were collapsing into the chasm. Rourke dodged the machine this way and that as best he could to avoid the rotor blades being struck. Above him, he could see Paul stabbing a shotgun downward. The flying rig was straining at full power, but John Rourke was nearly there. From his right, there was a blur of motion. A man appeared, then another and another, in flying rigs identical to his own, but these men were unburdened with additional pounds of equipment, and they knew their machine's capabilities, Rourke realized. As the nearer of the three made a pass toward him, a submachine gun in the fellow's hands, John Rourke swung Paul's submachine gun forward. A piece of flying debris struck Rourke's main rotor.
Shit!
The rotation speed immediately dropped, and the machine began to drop as well. The remaining two enemy personnel in flying rigs arced toward John Rourke. As he looked up, he saw Paul firing the shotgun. Rourke fired his submachine gun toward the last man. Rourke banked left, still falling, the now dead man's machine plummeting downward and downward into the seemingly bottomless chasm between the spiral and the outer wall. Rourke's eyes shifted over the controls in a frantic search for some means by which he could avoid his enemy's fate, a killing fall into the chasm. He throttled back one quarter, then turned the mixture control to full rich, simultaneously cutting power to half on his tail rotor. The flying rig lurched upward and began twisting so strongly that Rourke felt his lips curling back from his teeth. He was turning with the machine, with the increased power from the main rotor and the diminished tail rotor revolutions spiraling upward toward the ceiling above. The fingers of his right hand edged toward the bar to the platform control. It had to be dismounted, aimed. His fingers closed over the remote, and he wrenched it free, stabbing it outward, punching the control constantly, unable to see if he was having any effect, extending any of the mini-launch platforms used as takeoff and landing pads for the flying rigs. They wouldn't be everywhere, might only be on the outer wall side. John Rourke was nearly to the ceiling and nearly unconscious. He kept punching the platform control unit with his right hand and cut all power to the rotors with his left. Still spiraling, he started to fall. His right hand let go of the remote, and his left hand punched against the quick release for the harness, which was against his chest. He was free of the flying rig, tumbling, everything around him a blur now, black, edged with unconsciousness and nausea. His arms flailed and hands groped. The fingers of his left hand touched at synth concrete. His body slammed against something hard and bounced away from it, no longer spiraling, just dropping. His hand caught at something, and the falling stopped for a fraction of a second. His right hand was holding something, like a ledge. The blackness was closing around him. John Rourke swung his left arm outward and arced it upward, his left hand catching hold.
Damn stupid of me.
As Rourke's eyes focused, he almost laughed. His fingers were locked over the lip of one of the 4-foot walls. All of his efforts with the remote platform activator were for naught. He looked down. There were platforms open everywhere on both sides of the chasm, but he wasn't near any of them. Rourke looked up again. He was 3 levels down, and smoke billowed from the 2 highest levels. There was no sign of Paul. He started climbing upward. As he got his right arm over the wall, then started hauling his body after it, Paul was there.
You almost died!
Yeah, I know.
That was crazy! And then there you were, hanging onto this wall! You know what happened to your hat? You wouldn't want to know.
So what happened to my hat?
You were the luckiest man alive. A rotor blade sheared it away when you jerked free of the flying ring. An inch lower and it would have trimmed away the top of your head.
Yeah, well, I probably could have used a haircut anyway. How much trouble are we in?
Yeah, the police are poorly armed, but the defense forces, or army, or whatever, have a lot of firepower. The tactics look like a Chinese fire drill in the making, but I think Zimmer's probe got more than it bargained for. Zimmer's people got onto level 1 from the tunnel. Must be what happened to Spitz's force. They were brought straight in and we were taken downward by a trolley. The passes for the FBI here is on level 1, but near as I can make out, military headquarters is several levels down. Anyway, Zimmer's forces are being driven back. Could be trapped.
Take some of this stuff, huh?
Rourke started dividing his burdens with Paul.
Toward the center of level 5, I saw a kind of spiraling streak.
I saw it too, but from level 1.
Fine. Ever steal a carriage?
The briefcase discarded, his clothes stuffed into his musette bag, his boots knotted together and slung over his shoulder, and his leather jacket on instead of the tattered suit coat, John Rourke ran along a service alley on level 3 toward the street out front. Paul Rubinstein ran beside him. As long as the battle raged, there was a chance of escape. Once it stopped, they would be trapped in the city. The explosion still came, but more distant. Part of that was because they were near the inner core of level 3, not at its outer edge. But the explosions were less frequent now, too. The city itself was like a living organism, and it seemed seized with panic. Riot police battled civilians in the streets. There were overturned carriages and wagons and some small fires, perhaps from natural gas, perhaps electrical. Zimmer's forces had not penetrated far, but they had disrupted this city's apparently fragile infrastructure so severely that all the 1950s-style self-control was gone, the panic of upwelling, suppressed anxiety replacing it. As they reached the street, coming out between a mom-and-pop-style restaurant and a hairdressing salon, Rourke spotted a horse-drawn cab, the driver and 2 policemen fighting on the curb.
The cops are trying to steal that guy's cab!
Let's prevent them from doing that and take it ourselves. Come on!
Rourke broke into a dead run down the middle of the street, Paul beside him. Rourke's HK rifle was in his right fist, and he stabbed it toward the men fighting at the curb.
Everybody back up!
Paul covered them as they stepped back, while Rourke climbed into the driver's box. Rourke let his rifle fall to his side on its sling, grabbing a pistol from his belt and pointing at the 2 policemen and the cab driver.
Stay back and you won't get hurt! You try and stop us, you'll die! It's as simple as that!
Paul scrambled up into the passenger compartment and Rourke handed off his rifle to his friend.
Use it if you need it, Paul. Keep them covered while I get us out of here.
Rourke got the cab fully into the street.
Yeah!
They crossed an intersection, nearly colliding with an overturned produce wagon. Policemen were dismounting their bicycles, opening fire.
Discourage them, Paul!
What are we gonna do if we get out of here?
Ditch the cab and the team and steal a vehicle from the Nazis! That or an aircraft! They should be in row out there if we're lucky! We couldn't do anything else! We don't have clothes for the temperatures we'll encounter! Hang on!
Rourke slowed the team, took it into a turn, and they headed into the spiral of the core. It was steep here, well-paved, wide, but the turn's quick, and Rourke kept the team at the best speed he could. He had to save them for when they reached the tunnel leading out, because it was then that they would need all the speed they had. They reached level 2, passed it, and went on. The walls here were decorated with murals depicting the counterfeit warfare between the forces of this city and hordes of evilly drawn black men with savage looks in their eyes. Amid them, hawk-nosed, gray-complected men with leering expressions, driving the black men onward. The team was running evenly, not seeming to strain, as Rourke turned them into what he guessed was the final bend, ahead of the cab, half-blocking egress from the spiral. He saw men in the environmental suits of the military personnel who had captured them at the city entrance. The men were in a pack, not a formation, firing indiscriminately, it seemed, toward whatever lay beyond.
Stay down, Paul, and be ready!
Rourke hauled the reins close to his chest, twisting his body against them, the team turning, arcing right, straight toward the soldiers. The fighting men of the city within the mountain fell away in a wave on both sides. They were into level 1 now, fires burning everywhere, smoke billowing outward from buildings on both sides of the street here. Bodies of men and some horses were strewn about, as though discarded. Men in Nazi uniform, evidently the ones who had been in battle with the men from the city Rourke had just passed, started running from the path of the team. As Rourke hauled the team around a curve and through an intersection, he nearly lost control, tugging hard on the reins, swerving the team in order to avoid an overturned wagon which was on fire in the middle of the street, half blocking it. Ahead lay a barricade, intense fighting around it. John Rourke saw their chance. Beyond the barricade, perhaps 500 yards distant along the tunnel opening, were two armored Nazi staff cars. The barricade was the problem.
We're shooting our way through! It's the only way!
I'm with you, John! Ha!
Small units were in knots everywhere, exchanging fire, energy pulses, and projectile ammunition. Smoke, gray and acrid and foul, obscured everything to Rourke's right, two buildings on fire there. The team tore forward. Rourke crouched in the box, nearly but not quite seated. And they were into it. An energy burst impacted the pavement in front of the team, and the animal on the left reared. A man, one of the Nazis, ran toward the charging team, about to fire his energy rifle. The man fell away, the right front wheel of the cab rolling over his body. Rourke stabbed the pistol into his trouser band, its slide still locked open. They were nearly to the barricade now, a knot of soldiers from the city storming toward the cab, evidently to seize it and the team as their own means of flight. The horses ran wildly now of their own volition, running, it seemed, to get away from the gunfire and the energy weapon bursts and the smoke and fumes. They were past the barricade, into the tunnel. There were Nazis here, most of them retreating, some senior non-com supervising them. But whatever swell of victory was being felt by the defenders here would vanish with the next attack, because this had only been a probe to feel out the city's defensive capabilities. From the paucity of equipment and personnel on the Nazi side, that was obvious. A knot of Nazi personnel raised their energy weapons almost in unison as Rourke drove the team near them.
Paul, on your left! Come on, faster!
One of the armored staff cars Rourke had spotted was already in motion, escaping the tunnel to join a flow of vehicles well ahead of it. Rourke urged the animals onward, a spray of sweat from them like mist in the air. The armored staff car was picking up speed. Paul had read the intelligence data on these vehicles. Their gear ratio gave them horribly slow pickup, but they could top out over 100 miles per hour on smooth level surfaces.
Paul, jump for it! Be ready! Yeah, horses! Yeah!
They were nearly even with the staff car, but in seconds its engine would outpace the team. Rourke edged the cab closer. The staff car's turret hatch opened on top, a man with an energy rifle sticking up through it, about to fire.
Look out, John!
In the distance, John could see the interior boundaries of the airfield taxi zone, some from the number of this eclectic collection burning or already gutted to blackened ribs. The team was running even with the armored car. Rourke glanced back and saw Paul jump. Paul caught hold of a grab handle, his feet dragging for an instant. Another man appeared at the turret hatch, a pistol in hand. As the man aimed his pistol toward Paul, Rourke's left hand darted under his battered old brown bomber jacket to the Detonix minigun under his right armpit. Paul pulled himself up, aboard at last. Rourke safed the little Detonix and shoved it into his left front trouser pocket. He balanced himself on the edge of the box and the seat, then threw down the reins and jumped. He missed his mark, landing hard, sprawling over the armored staff car's hood. His hands grasped at the barrel protruding from the gun turret above him. He clung there, the hood surface steeply angled, hard for his feet to find purchase there. Paul was up by the hatch, firing downward. Rourke hauled his body up, clambering over the gun barrel and onto the turret beside his friend at last. Rourke reached to the small of his back, grabbing for the old metalized Colt Lawman 357.
Ready!
Cover our backs!
Rourke grabbed the turret ladder and vaulted through into the hatchway, the revolver in his right fist, his left hand clinging to the rung of the ladder. A half-dozen dead bodies littered the interior of the armored staff car, some of them officers. A man, bleeding badly, sat at the automobile-like controls of the machine. He twisted around and began raising a pistol.
Don't make me shoot!
But the man punched his pistol forward. On the video monitor by which the man steered, Rourke saw the burning wreckage of one of the aircraft coming up fast, too fast. Rourke stabbed the stubby .357 into his hip pocket as he threw himself forward, then wrestled the dead man away from the steering controls. The armored staff car was nearly into the flames.
Hold on tight, Paul! Hold on!
The armored staff car veered suddenly left, away from the burning aircraft, into the tunnel roadway. Rourke dropped into the driver's seat and stomped the accelerator control pedal, the armored staff car picking up speed.
And now? Zimmer's headquarters after we find an aircraft?
There was the sound of the hatch closing as Rourke turned the staff car into the flow of traffic, mini-tanks, more staff cars, and a few trucks. There was comforting anonymity here. On the indicator panel in front of Rourke, the hatch's ceiling was confirmed, and the environmental system automatically kicked in, a rush of pleasantly warm air surrounding Rourke. Ahead lay the mouth of the tunnel, Nazi vehicles and foot soldiers funneling through it. It would be easy to continue to mingle with them, avoid detection. Except for serial markings, all the staff cars looked alike. Already, Rourke was slowing down, letting the staff car drift to the rear of the force. He would break off at the first opportunity after they were outside.
We'll have to get in touch with the SEAL team that's shepherding Natalia and Annie near Zimmer's headquarters. Have them get the women and Michael out of there.
What about Sarah and Wolfgang Ma? We have to go in after them. Zimmer might kill them for spite.
With that SEAL team helping us and assuming Zimmer's down to a significantly reduced garrison at his headquarters, it shouldn't be too bad. And after we get Sarah and Wolf out, then we destroy the place if we have to, or hold it as a staging area against Eden.
Soon, Eden and its Nazi allies would attack. With any luck, Eden City's bio-warfare facility was already destroyed, perhaps setting back the timetable for the attack on Hawaii. Hawaii and the United States forces assembled there, the true linchpin of the Transglobal Alliance. It was war again.
And then, come back here. This stops him before he makes himself invincible, and we'll never be able to stop him at all.
Survivalist Blood Assassins is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1992, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Laura Quinn Anderson, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, M.B. Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Scott McCormick, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. Adapted and directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth and James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in graphic audio.
I am Sakage, a lord of shadows. I claim the shadows that the shadow may not. I am the strong arm of deliverance. I am Shadow Strider. All the pieces will be put into play. I am the scales of justice. I am he who guards unseen. I am Shadow Slayer. I am nameless. A new darkness will rise. My way is hard, but I serve unbroken. I will do justice and love mercy. The final battle will threaten all the world. Until the king returns, I shall not lay my burden down. And only Kyler can stand in the way of the Krull.
Yes, there's no way to win except to raise these monsters. It will be an orgy of death.
Then let us raise monsters.
The end is nigh. Find out where all the pieces fall in Beyond the Shadows, Parts 1 and 2. Available in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net.